Spirit Blade Underground, episode 459. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 459.
And welcome to the monitor room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and community you can check out at christiangeekcentral.com. I'm Peter Franson, recording at 4:26 in the a.m. I've been having trouble sleeping. I think it's just because I had way too much, like, caffeine. I took a nap late in the afternoon yesterday. It was just kind of a recipe for disaster. So since I couldn't sleep, tossing and turning in bed for the last about hour or so, even after taking some melatonin in the middle of the night, I thought, well, I'm going to need to sleep later on, so I can't afford to lose the productivity time. I better get up and get at it until I'm ready to collapse again, which will probably happen about 15 minutes before I'm supposed to get my boys up to get ready for school. So we'll just see how it all plays out. But anyway, that's why my voice sounds a little bit husky, and maybe why I'm speaking just a little bit more softly. I don't have a sense of the kind of like how sound travels from out of my office yet. And my office is just across the hall from our bedroom. Now, there is two doors, you know, in a hallway, and then a big box fan blowing in our bedroom. So, you know, I don't think I would be able to wake up my wife here. In my last office was actually much closer, and I would do extra life in there in our old house and, you know, be like yelling and jumping and shouting. But then again, you know, she would go to sleep with that in the background. Maybe she just adjusted to that. I don't know what would happen if I suddenly started being really loud in here. I don't know. Anyway, so if you notice a different tone for this episode, with the exception of the review of the movie review, specifically the Alien Covenant movie review, that's what's going on there. Anyway, I am Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to hopefully equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. For more info and free goodies, check out spiritblade.com. On the show today, though, a review of Alien Covenant. Did I say that right? Covenant. An alternative and probably more popular perspective on Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, plus some thoughts on why the local church, with all its mess, is still worth joining. All right, lots of stuff. Let's get to it.
Well, thank you all for joining me on this historic day. The serum I've created will give anyone who drinks it the power to objectively know the difference between something that is cool and something that is lame. The serum is available to anyone who provides a review for the Spirit Blade Underground podcast and is completely safe. Allow me to demonstrate. Alien Covenant. All right, the synopsis on IMDb reads, "The crew of the colony ship Covenant, bound for a remote planet on the far side of the galaxy, discovers what they think is an uncharted paradise, but is actually a dark, dangerous world. When they uncover a threat beyond their imagination, they must attempt a harrowing escape." Okay, let's try that again. "The crew of the, let's say, the something-something space truck tanker ship, blah, 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 bound for a remote planet on the far side, or bound for home, we'll say, coming from the far side of the galaxy, discovers what they think is something that's not dangerous, but is actually a dark, dangerous world. When they uncover a threat beyond their imagination, they must attempt a harrowing escape. That was the plot to the first Alien movie, okay? I just swapped out a few words, and you got the plot to Alien Covenant. I loved Prometheus. I really enjoyed that movie. I wanted a continuation of that story. Each Alien movie, I think, has brought something unique to the series. Now, we definitely got to know that creature, I feel like, from head to toe by the end of the second movie, but each one brought something different in terms of what type of movie it was. You know, the first one was like, that was Alien, that was like a horror movie, okay? Second one was like a sci-fi action, you know, with definitely horror as well. The third one, a little more back to its horror roots, but it was also this just kind of weird conceptual type of sci-fi movie, you know, and dealt with kind of like these more philosophical type of themes, or at least vibes, you know, if they didn't, you know, really play around with themes in a straightforward way. And then in the fourth one, it was creepy and disturbing rather than like being scary and like a horror movie. It was this disturbing kind of weird, I don't know, French vibe or whatever. I don't know exactly what was going on with that. But there was something kind of fresh. It was apples and oranges with each one of those movies. And this is the first one, you know, like all of the Alien movies up to this point, with the exception of, say, like the spinoffs like Alien versus Predator stuff, I feel like each of the Alien movies was made to serve a creative vision. And this movie, for the first time, largely felt made to serve business decisions after the somewhat negative response that Prometheus got. Business decisions that result in a plot that felt to me forced back to a safer direction for the folks who just want to see that same alien again for the umpteenth time. So the folks that want to see that alien again, they don't want these weird new alien ideas. They just want, give us the alien, give us the facehuggers. They're getting it. They're getting it. Not through the whole movie. The story in many ways retraces, I think, the plot skeleton of the original Alien. I don't want to make too much of that because I didn't really notice that happening until at some point in the middle, or especially toward the end of the movie. So it definitely has a lot of different flavors of meat on its bones. But I mean, I can see that a very similar structure there. And it forces a resolution to the Prometheus plotline, along with this kind of jarring course change. Many people might think of it as a course correction. I'm just going to say a course change. I, from my taste, it's not going in a direction I wanted it to go. The first half of the movie was great for me. I felt tense. My jaw dropped at some of the horrifying character deaths, just like horrible stuff happening to people. There was weird body horror and different. It wasn't the same classic xenomorph for that first half hour. It was like other weird stuff, something that was kind of like a xenomorph, and other bad things happening to people's bodies because of alien weirdness. I was on the edge of my seat waiting for each next moment that was going to be coming and wondering, oh my gosh, where's this whole thing going? It was great stuff. And then the second half of the movie, somewhere around in there, it brought this abrupt, hard turn resolution, I guess, is what they're going for, to the Prometheus plot. Michael Fassbender's, Foss or Fass, I'm not sure. But his android David character returns, but has taken, I think, a sharp turn away from who he was as an individual and in his relationship, especially to Dr. Shaw. I don't think it's completely out of character. I can see this is like where his character would go, and this story does take place 10 years later, but especially in his where they left his relationship with Dr. Shaw at the end of Prometheus to where we find out it went, you know, in this one, I'm just like, man, that feels, ugh, that does not feel like this organic advancement of what was going on between those two characters in Prometheus. So that was a bummer. Dr. Shaw is not in this movie at all. There is a reveal of what happened to her, and I found it extremely unsatisfying, and I felt robbed of the rest of her story that I felt like was intended to be told before Prometheus kind of got negative responses to it. It definitely seemed like it was going to continue her story after Prometheus. And so this does not feel like it is growing out of the original creative vision. It feels like it's a response to, it's business. It feels like business. And then after that rough course change and the story reveals that come along with it, the final third of the movie brings back the classic alien and the face huggers that I guess people missed in Prometheus. But for me, monster movies are about the mystery of the monster and the slow reveal of this unknown creature. It's about fear of the unknown, especially at the beginning. And then slowly we learn more and more, and our jaws drop further and further as we discover really the degree to which this creature is messed up and jacked up and horrifying and very capable of killing anything it comes across, you know. So that's a big part of monster movie experiences for me. But the problem is, I know this creature. I've known it from, like I said, I feel like from head to toe by the end of the second Alien movie. And that's why what made the Alien movies after that interesting was that the setting or the story kind of went in some weird and unusual directions. Otherwise, I think I would have been disappointed just with them just recycling the same creature and not revealing anything new about it. So my one hope for the series is the fact that, no spoilers, they leave things in an interesting place that has potential, I think, for where the next movie will start and go from there. It won't necessarily be creative and interesting, but it certainly has potential. Like, oh, if they pick up in the next movie right where they leave off, or if there is a sequel to this, because I think the next one's going to pick up with the Sigourney Weaver character again, and they're going to retcon, destroy the continuity of the third and fourth Alien movie or something. But anyway, when they come back to the characters that survived this story, I think they're being left in a potentially very interesting place. Anyway, if they do still, even on top of that, keep using the creature, the same creature over and over again, and in the same ways, like, I would be open to using the same creature if it evolves in some way, if it changes, and if it adapts biologically in some way and makes it less predictable in terms of what it's capable of. Or, you know, I don't want to, like, you know, have it jump the shark. That's hard territory to get into, because it could easily jump the shark if you just keep stacking new powers on top of it or something like that. But man, if they could find a way to keep revealing things about this alien, or at least take the story in just some radically creative and interesting directions, which is what I thought Prometheus was, but maybe with the classic Alien missing as well, it was just too much of a departure for some people. Anyway, if they don't do something to kind of change it up and keep changing it up, I think I'm totally going to lose interest in this series, which is a real bummer for me. As far as the cast, I want to say that I thought it was a great cast. The first hour has some really nice character stuff that gave them a chance to perform, and the groundedness of that character stuff, it reminded me of, you know, the first Alien movie that had all these kind of grounded characters. There was improvisation and stuff going on in the filming of the first movie that I don't think was really present here, but these were still grounded character performances compared to a lot of the other Alien movies. And when the characters to me feel more real, like people I've maybe met or could meet, then the horror feels more real. So I really appreciated that. As far as the stunts and visuals, the Ridley Scott production quality is here in full force throughout the whole movie. The great sets, great visual effects and practical effects, and a nice blend of the two that keeps me kind of guessing a little bit. And especially in some of, like, these horrible deaths that characters experience, they're using a lot of practical effects too, and it makes it all the more, like, disturbingly real feeling, you know. So I really appreciated that. And even in what was for me the disappointing second half of the movie, the visual design, just the world, and looking at the world and the things in it and the people in it and stuff like that, just the way it all looked and the vibe that I was picking up from the world, it kept me engaged. And so big props go to Ridley Scott for his direction throughout the movie, even if for me the story fell short. All right, so I always try to ask myself, you know, when I'm watching entertainment or playing entertainment or whatever, is there anything of worthwhile moral, philosophical, or spiritual significance that might result in worthwhile conversation or thought as a result, taking in the entertainment? And I don't know. I mean, I think there's, like, things that potentially could, but I don't feel like the ideas are quite explored enough to really say anything significant that we could, you know, react to, you know, committing to any, you know, really strong kind of ideas that we could react to. Let's see. There is a return to the Prometheus movie's questions about origins of life, and specifically the nature of our creator, or as they establish in Prometheus, creators, the idea that humanity was created ultimately by an alien race. But these themes are only touched on again rather than really explored, you know, because they're part of that, I think, that plot that they wanted to get out of the way as soon as possible before Prometheus put that to rest and get on with the more classic Alien type of movie. So that, you know, that whole illogical planet seeding thing to try to reduce God to, you know, being an alien race or an alien being or something like that, that's still part of the continuity, but it's not strong because they're really trying to just, okay, we got to touch on this, but let's get it out of the way as quick as we can. That's kind of what it feels like. Billy Crudup, or Crudup, I'm not sure how you say his name, from Dr. Manhattan from Watchmen. He plays a captain in this movie who immediately inherits his rank when the assigned captain dies. And that's not a spoiler because it happens before we even get a good look at the assigned captain's face, you know. And so his character is really insecure, and he's not ready for the position. We've seen these kind of characters before. They kind of like, they're in a position of power, but they're insecure, and so they kind of try to take too much control of things, you know? And, you know, they kind of go the route of the spineless villain as opposed to, like, the evil villain. They're the spineless villain who eventually gets their own in the end because of all the trouble that they cause people throughout the movie. And that's what I thought they were going to go in, especially when he revealed himself as a person of faith and described how he felt like people of faith in this world, in this setting, are treated like lunatics who can't think reasonably or logically. And yet logic and reason are high values of his, even if he sometimes can't tell when it's his insecurities are actually taking control and he's maybe trying to put forth the idea that he's thinking logically, but it's actually his insecurities that are in the driving seat. The driver's seat. That's how you say that, right? Anyway, so I thought, oh, are they going to like just kind of make him the spineless, you know, pain in the butt character, you know, and you know, portray him just as what he feared, you know, as this kind of like lunatic, illogical guy or whatever. But he was actually handled more fairly and complexly than that. Complexly? Is that a word? Jeez. I got up at 3 o'clock this morning, so I'm ready to be done. He actually has some admirable moments despite his obvious built-in character flaws. And so he was an interesting character to watch, and his faith is even respected and valued at one point as an important commodity by another character. So, yeah, I thought it was an interesting treatment of that character. All right, well, I have no idea what your tastes are. Hopefully you'll totally get what you want out of this experience. But if I were a time traveler, I'd go back in time and say, Peter, skip this one and buy it when it kind of gets a little cheap. Not doesn't have to be bargain bin cheap, but you know, about like $10 off the full price or $5 off the, you know, when it's kind of on sale ish, you know, because it's one you're going to want to have because the first hour is awesome and you're going to want to own it just for the first hour alone. It's got those great Ridley Scott production values that take you through the whole movie, but the story is going to fall flat for you big time right about halfway through, making this one that you can wait on watching until you need to watch it to catch up on whatever the next Alien movie is that picks up where this one leaves off. It's rated R for sci-fi violence, bloody images, language, and some sexuality/nudity. And I'll add, because it's something that I'm sensitive to and I would want to know, it's very brief nudity. You'll miss it if you blink. There you have it. That's my thoughts on Alien Covenant. I want to remind you guys to check out the other members of the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, the Untold podcast, POS, TOS, and Helix Reviews. For more information about the CGC network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
Hello, and we just finished watching Guardians of the Galaxy. Or Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, pardon me. Mm-hmm. I say that because it felt very similar to the first one, and I agree with what Peter said. If you liked the first one, you will like this, and if you didn't like the first one, you won't like this. Since we loved the first one, we really enjoyed this one.
Yeah, it had of course, you're never going to have the same novelty as the first one.
But that was more than just novelty that made us enjoy it. That's why we watched it repeatedly.
It's a mistake to make on novelty, but it does have the same kind of humor rhythm of the first one, where whenever it starts getting really serious, they'll
take the piss out of the moment. Yeah. They'll throw in a joke. They'll have and then as things start getting too silly, all of a sudden they'll turn and bring in real danger, real heartfelt emotion.
And that's the thing, is there are some genuinely affecting scenes in this.
Some dark, serious stuff. And again, I don't know why. Painter's one of the people, and others too, talk about the Marvel movies like they're just all nothing but a bunch of jokes and one-liners. Like,
they're
it's Looney Tunes.
They're too silly. They're too bright.
And it's like, I haven't seen a Marvel movie that hasn't had serious, meaningful stuff in it. Even the silliest stuff. And this is full of that. I mean, this. What I like is there's a pattern that's coming out. We saw it with Black Panther in Civil War, and we're seeing it here, is they'll introduce a character, and then if the character's of interest, then they'll go into his or her origin story. And I like that method.
Rather than always opening with the origin story as the classic formula.
This, we're going to find out everything we need to know about Star-Lord's origin. And it was hinted at in the first movie, and they paid off very well. I don't know if they thought in detail about where it was going to go, but I thought... I will say this, I can say with pride, I pretty much called exactly what was happening with his father and that whole subplot from the beginning.
Well, you knew testify. It was going to have to go one of two ways.
And it went the more predictable way. But to me, predictable doesn't mean bad. The only reason I can predict stories like I can is because I've seen so many of these, and I love this story structure. It's a good, solid story structure, and there are still moments that surprised me and affected me. I will say, if you enjoyed the pop music of the first one, I personally didn't find this pop music as...
Yeah, I didn't think the music was quite as good.
None of the songs were songs I was like, oh, I know that song. It's like, I might have heard them on the radio,
there
but...
There were a couple that I recognized that I'm like, oh, I haven't heard that one in years.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's for me personally, the music wasn't... But it wasn't bad or anything. It was much the same style and era of music, which makes sense because... Ostensibly, Peter's mom had given him the soundtrack to the second movie at the end of the first. And they do the same thing here where he gets a soundtrack ostensibly to the next movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's going to be the patterns. At the end of every movie, Peter gets another source of music. Although a lot of the aliens seem to be really into Peter's music. Do any aliens in the Marvel Universe make their own music? Because it seems like the only music they ever want to listen to, and we saw that in Guardians 1 with the prison guard who stole his stuff, they just, oh, we just love this human music. It's the only music we like.
Well, and even Peter's dad seemed to genuinely enjoy the music.
Yeah, they actually used the song Brandy as like kind of a character plot point.
It didn't seem to me like he was doing that purely as a way to bond with Peter.
Yeah.
It seemed like he genuinely enjoyed that stuff.
Yeah, he genuinely identified with that song, and it became actually a good way to reveal his character. And obviously we don't want to spoil that for you. Trying to think what else there is about this movie.
That we can tell you without ruining it.
They do really do a good job expanding pretty much all the characters from the first movie, the major characters, which are the Five Guardians and Yondu.
Well, and also Nebula.
And Nebula, that's right, I forgot Nebula. Yeah, they really expand what we see of them. Everything, and I know a little bit of the expanded stuff, the comic stuff that they put into that movie as background that they didn't reference, and here they reference it like it was always the case, which is nice. It really adds more detail without contradicting things. Not much to say about this because otherwise we'd just be talking about remember this scene, remember that scene. It felt like the same thing where there's some action set pieces and there's some wild, crazy action. To be honest, I've never been a big fan of action scenes by themselves. Not unless there's some good character moments or something going on, novelty.
Well, and I think that's the thing is that, like we were talking about, the plot is pretty basic. And if you are at all trope savvy, you will probably predict where a lot of things are going to go. But when you have interesting character interactions, it keeps the ride fun.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is as long as you care about the characters, and, you know, that's going to be a person-to-person thing. If you like these characters from the first movie, you'll like them here, I think. Nothing really feels like it's betraying what they were from the first movie. Nothing feels like, it's the same people who made it, so it stands to reason. You know how sometimes you see a sequel, like for me a good example is How to Train Your Dragon 2. I thought that really betrayed the first movie. Because the core plot of the second movie kind of undid the core message of the first movie. This does not feel like that. This doesn't feel like it undoes something from the first movie. It just builds on it and expands and goes forward.
Yeah, it does a good job of reinforcing that foundation.
I do like... We did a quick flash at the beginning of the movie to the late 70s, early 80s. And Kim and I both noticed and talked to each other about, isn't that cool how that... Because they went to a Dairy Queen. And the Dairy Queen looked like what Dairy Queens looked like back then.
Yeah.
And then we flash briefly to that same location now, and it looked like what Dairy Queens look like now. And this is a nice little bit.
They had updated the facade of the building.
And nothing, it was not called attention. It was just like, it was just the scene. It was just that nice little bit.
It was only like a 5 seconds each time that you looked at it, if that. But they paid attention to these
and
sorts of things.
I think of that with Captain America versus, I know you said this with X-Men First Class. The MCU movies seem really good at period stuff.
Yeah.
When it feels like they're in a different period.
When they do a period piece, they do a good job of capturing the feel of the era.
As opposed to Sony, which kind of feels like modern people dressed from a vintage store.
Yeah.
But that's a mild, again, that's just a minor detail. I really love the Stanley cameo. It might even be better than Amazing Spider-Man's Stanley cameo.
And it confirms the long-standing theory about Stanley cameos.
Yes, if you know the internet fan theory about the Stanley cameos, this all but confirmed that theory, which was awesome. And if you don't know it, then it's just like a guy acting weird talking to people. And again, the more you know, the more you'll get it. But, you know, it's just a gag. So if you don't know that, you can move on.
I remember Pater saying that he found the character of Mantis kind of interesting.
I liked her.
And
she was a breath of fresh air because everyone else in this, except for Groot, who doesn't actually truly talk, is like so cynical and wry and all this. And Mantis is a complete innocent.
Well, and she spends a lot of time partnered with Drax in this story, which I think is a good match.
Yeah, they're a good fit together.
They are both kind of clueless in their own way.
And very straightforward.
In different ways. And they play off each other very well.
In some ways, it's almost like the same person before and after a terrible tragedy. Because Drax has suffered terrible tragedies and loss. And in fact, there's a touching scene where Mantis, because she can feel your emotions.
Yeah.
And she like actually, she touches him and feels his emotions and feels his loss. And I really liked also, I hope this doesn't ruin it for you, but they did not make them a romantic pairing. And that was a nice, you kind of expected they would, but they didn't. Because I'm tired of that stupid cliche of, oh, well, if you got a man and a woman together, they have to get together as a couple. I was like, no, they don't. They can just be friends. And I like that.
Mm-hmm.
I of course Rocket is still my favorite character, so I was loving it. It got some good insight into Rocket, and he had some good stuff. Is Groot still your favorite?
See, I don't know if Groot is my very favorite, but Groot is up there. It's hard for me to pick a very favorite because I think the best aspect of these movies is how the characters play off one another.
Yeah, it is a good ensemble piece.
You've got to have all the parts of the ensemble, or it doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As usual, I say if there's a weak character, it'd probably be Gamora. But it's not so much that she's weak, is that she's not fun.
She always has to be the straight man.
Yeah, she's the straight man. She's a serious one. She's the conscience of the team who says, this is what we have to do because it's right. You know, I have a bad feeling about this, etc. So she's valuable and important. She's just not nearly as fun as the others. She doesn't get very many. Most of her good snark lines are when she misstates something. Like, I don't know what David Hasselhoff is, so I call him something else. And,
yeah.
But, although if you like cute, cuddly, adorable things, Groot is going to be a good thing for you. Because Kim was going insane with, oh, over little toddler Groot.
It's adorable.
So if you like cute toddler stuff, that's a good source. That's, anything more to say?
I think, although I do not agree with Pater's assessment of this movie, I agree with his recommendation that if you liked the first one, see this. If you didn't like the first one, give it a pass.
And pretty much the level to which you would do that is to the same degree that you liked or disliked the first one. It feels, again, about the same in quality, just not as novel, not as surprising. But other than that, if you've watched it more than once and still enjoyed it, I would definitely go for this. That's about all there is, so we'll see you next time.
Data collection complete. Activating Usenet 1.0.
This week at spiritblade.com, you can find an interview that I just did with Todd Lewis over at the Praise of Folly podcast. And this is a video interview with a split screen with me and Todd sharing our conversation. And he asked me questions about the Spirit Blade trilogy and the Pilgrim's Progress trilogy. And we even get into a little bit of what might be coming. Or no, I said Pilgrim's Progress trilogy, didn't I? Series. That's a series, not a trilogy. And we even talked about what kind of might be coming. I wasn't able to reveal very much, but there are some maybe little hints and tidbits that you can pick up there if you're interested. And we also just talked about the, you know, the state of Christian fiction in general and some of my thoughts on that. So anyway, you can find that on our news page at spiritblade.com. Let's see, what else? At christiangeekcentral.com this week. UK Steve gives us another Red Dwarf article, finishing up his coverage of Red Dwarf Season 1. You can check that out. The article is titled Red Dwarf Confidence, Paranoia, and Me Squared. And then also I put a just some info up there about the Summer of Free Movie Club, which we're going to be starting, which is going to be an event this summer. We are partnering with the Retro Rewind podcast to present the Summer of Free Movie Club. Each month during the summer, we'll be putting a spotlight on a free geek genre movie that you can watch for free and legally online. And then the Retro Rewind podcast will host a Google Hangout to talk about the movie of the month, specifically some of the spiritual themes. And you're welcome to join in and be a part of that Google Hangout. The first movie being featured is Last Action Hero, which you can watch right now until the end of May on Crackle.com. Then after you've had a chance to check it out, you're invited to join the Google Hangout discussing the potential spiritual themes of the movie. The Hangout will be on Saturday, June 3rd, starting at noon Pacific time. And I will put a, I'll try to put a link to that Hangout in the show notes for this. But you can also find it on the at christiangeekcentral.com and summerofffree.com, where I've posted the article The Summer of Free Movie Club. The first link for the first Hangout is included there as well. So I hope you guys will check that out. In the meantime, stay tuned. Even though I'm talking about Summer of Free stuff right now, the Summer of Free 2017 officially kicks off next week. I just wanted to be sure you knew about The Last Action Hero being available on Crackle.com, because I think it's going to be removed at the end of May. So you want to take advantage of that now so you can be a part of that conversation. So let's see, what else? At youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. I just put up a video. It's another one in my Extra Life 2016 highlight series, in which I am schooled in Portal 2 by my two young boys who, just by watching, you know, a bunch of YouTube videos and stuff, they know that game back and forth. I've even beaten it, and I feel like they know the game better than I do, especially the two-player stuff, which was kind of what we were playing around with. So anyway, you can see them totally school me in Portal 2. And then also a mystery guest shows up for the stream, and I give viewers a chance to guess who they are. I present some clues, and then the guest is revealed after just a few minutes. So you can be a part of the guessing if you didn't see who the mystery guest was live during the Extra Life stream last October. And then, of course, my Alien Covenant review should be there as well. I didn't post the first part of the Horizon Zero Dawn themes video series, which it is going to be a series. But I did finally record it all. It's just a matter of editing it down now, which isn't taking long. It's going really fast. I'm not even having to edit it down. It's all just edit my comments with the associated clips that go with it. So I've already finished basically the first video, which I'll be putting up next week. It just wasn't quite done soon enough to go up this week. So look for that next week. I hope that's going to be a series that people will find interesting. It will have a lot of spoilers in it, but if you don't mind spoilers for that game, or if you've finished the game already, I hope it's a video series that you'll enjoy. And then while you're there, if you want to like there and subscribe, then of course that'd be helpful to me and to Spirit Blade, or Christian Geek Central. All right, at youtube.com/spiritbladevideos, I've put up, man, there's a lot to announce this week, isn't there? I put up the A World of Shadows commentary part 8, in which I talk about working with my wife and avoiding demon possession, which are two totally unrelated topics. Oh, hang on a second. I'm a little dried out here. All right. Thank you. Sorry for that. All right. We're almost through here, Peter. That's at youtube.com/spiritbladevideos. Okay. Speaking of my wife, if you've been on the forums and specifically to the prayer request section of the forums, then you may know that my wife has kind of entered into a tough season with her work. We hope it's just a season. There's just some things that have changed about the status quo of her job that have introduced a lot of stress to it, which has been really rough for her. There are some possible, you know, solutions and resolutions that will, you know, improve things. But for a little while here, at least, she's going to have just some stressful stuff she's going to have to deal with at work, which really sucks. For more details, you can check out the prayer request section of the forums at ChristianGeekCentral.com. Anyway, it reminded me of something that I've kind of wanted to do for a while. You know, we, as of last September, began celebrating the 10th anniversary of Spirit Blade Productions, 10 years of doing this crazy, weird ministry that just keeps morphing and changing. And but through all of that, one thing that's been consistent is that it's only been possible because of my wife, because my wife is able to work in a field that that pays well enough that that I can afford to give my time entirely or almost entirely to this ministry, to Spirit Blade Productions, to the audio drama stuff, and to Christian Geek Central. For those of you who don't know, you know, I do charge for the audio dramas, but that's really all that I charge for. And it's such a niche crowd that, I mean, there's no way that that can really contribute to our income. It's just recently reached the point between audio drama sales and Spirit Blade Insiders where we can now finally stop putting our own money into Spirit Blade Productions. And it's reached the point of, I think, being safely self-sustaining, provided things, you know, kind of continue as they have been for a while. So so that's a neat place to be, but it's still certainly not a contributor to our family income. And so and Holly has been content to do that, to work in a job that does not give her any, you know, content, any fulfillment, you know. It's just something that she does, and she's been absolutely content to do that, even though, you know, it's got its sucky parts, you know, it's a job, you know. But anyway, I just thought this would be a really good time to follow through on an idea I had that I wanted to do before we kind of hit year 11, while we're still kind of in the mode of, you know, recognizing the 10 years of Spirit Blade Productions. I would just love for Holly, my wife, to hear from those of you who, for whom Spirit Blade Productions has meant something special. I've heard from a number of you on and off over the years, and I've passed that along from time to time to Holly. What I would love is for her to hear directly from you. And by directly, I mean kind of indirectly. What I want to invite you to do is send me an email at paeter@spiritblade.com. So send it to my email, but just address your words to Holly and share with her something of what Spirit Blade Productions has meant to you. If it's just a quick little, you know, casual, you know, thank you or whatever, you know, and it's not anything deep, then that would be great. But I mean, if you do, I'm not going to be publishing or, you know, publicly sharing, you know, these letters or these emails. So, I mean, if you would like to go into something a little bit more personal, that would be very meaningful. So anything that Spirit Blade Productions or Christian Geek Central has meant to you, I would love for Holly to hear about and for you to thank her for the work that she's done for the last 10 years to make this possible. If she was not doing the work that she's doing, then Spirit Blade Productions would have vanished a long time ago. So we have a lot to thank Holly Franson for, and I would love for her to hear from you on that. So I'll be reminding you guys of that from now until the deadline that I'm setting, which is going to be Sunday, June 25th. In the meantime, yeah, I would love to get your messages for her. Just saying thank you and expressing, you know, what something of what Spirit Blade Productions or Christian Geek Central has meant to you. Again, my email address, paeter@spiritblade.com. I'd be very grateful for your help with that. Let's see. I think that's it. Let's get on with the rest of this stuff.
The truth will set you free.
Truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. Lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
All right, in this segment, I attempt to examine the Bible and dissect some of what I would call the churchy language that we can often take for granted, digging into history and languages when I'm able to try and get at the heart of the text so we can hopefully see and apply some of what God has for us in these words today. Now, I'm not formally trained in scripture. I'm just a guy using resources and a questioning mind to try and get at the truth. That's something I think we can all do in this internet age, and so I hope that you'll do that with me. This time, we are looking at the book of Ephesians, chapter 4, verses 14 through 16, which in the ESV reads, "So that we may no longer be children." I know this is a little out of context. I was going to do kind of like this, take a running start at it after reading the text for this week. Actually, let me do this a little out of order from what my notes say. So just kind of in review, reviewing chapter 4, verses 1 through 6, in light of the fact that believers, despite their extreme differences, are forgiven and adopted into the same family through belief in the rescuing work of Jesus, Paul is urging his readers here, who come from very different social backgrounds, to live and serve together in a manner worthy of the hope we have because of how God called each of us to himself. And then regarding verses 7 through 11, as we pursue living life in a way that is worthy of that hope, Jesus has equipped men and women with specific roles with which to serve and lead in both the local and the worldwide church. And then regarding verses 12 and 13, the purpose of this distribution of gifts is to help us all mature in wisdom, spiritual discipline, holiness, or we might say set apartness for God, and contentment, with the aim of being unified in what we believe and trust about Jesus, engaging in all that he has purposed for us in this life. And then now verses 14 through 16 in the ESV reads, "So that we may no longer be children, tossed to and fro by the waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by human cunning, by craftiness and deceitful schemes. Rather, speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and held together by every joint with which it is equipped, when each part is working properly, makes the body grow so that it builds itself up in love." All right, so first looking at verse 14, which again says, "So that we may no longer be children tossed to and fro by the waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by human cunning, by craftiness in deceitful schemes." This maturity we are meant to grow in will increasingly prevent us from being tossed by waves, an expression used metaphorically in Greek to refer to being troubled or nervous. The source of this agitation might be linked to being carried about by every wind of doctrine, as it says, which in the literal Greek expresses the idea of being swung around. It was an expression used of spinning tops and of feeling dizzy, which makes sense given the confused and dizzying effect that popular false teaching brings into our lives. Both from outside the church and from within, we witness popular philosophical movements kind of come and go. This can include trends in corporate worship or even changes in how we fundamentally read and interpret the Bible. A growing maturity as we walk with Christ protects us from the anxiety and confusion that can accompany mental confrontations with persuasive yet false thinking. The sources of false doctrine are identified here as, one, human cunning. The word for cunning here in the Greek literally means dice playing, excuse me, and was a metaphor of the day used to describe deceivers, since dice players often deceived those they played with. You know, similar to how we can describe manipulative people as, like, used car salesmen. And then two, the other source of false doctrine identified is craftiness in deceitful schemes. The Greek word for craftiness here describes a cunning without moral limitations. So someone with a single focus on their agenda without concern for anything else. All right, so looking at verse 15 now, which again reads, "Rather speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ." Instead of adopting false teaching, we promote maturity and unity between ourselves and other Christians by, one, speaking the truth in love. This is a very popular phrase in kind of Christian culture. It's one that we appeal to and kind of try to hold ourselves to, I think, pretty often. It's easy, though, and wrong, actually, to think of speaking truth and speaking in love as mutually exclusive traits, as though one can compromise the other. Properly understood, they don't compromise each other. There's actually a lot of overlap between the two. The Greek compound word for speaking the truth here more strictly translates to doing the truth. If we only verbally teach or proclaim truth, or maybe approach it in this kind of academic sense where we put it out there, you know, in a kind of an academic, somewhat detached way, then we're missing the mark that's intended here. As Zondervan Publishing's Expositor's Bible Commentary clarifies regarding this phrase, truthing it in love, as they say, involves not only declaring and defending the faith with charitable words, but also matching such words with compatible attitudes and actions. The Greek word for love here is agape, which we've looked at before. Agape is a love that both prioritizes others above oneself and serves others in the way that is best for them, not always in the way they would prefer. So there is potential for agape to be tough love, but not to the exclusion of genuine, heartfelt concern and compassion. All right, so the other way that we promote maturity and unity between ourselves and other Christians is by growing up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ. The metaphor isn't crystal clear here, but whether we are growing to become like Christ or growing toward a deep connection and partnership with him, as the body is to a head, Christ himself is the standard. He is the first of this new kind of human that God is developing us into for an eternal future with him and for eternal community with others. All right, verse 16 says, "From whom the whole body," so it's talking about Christ, "from whom the whole body, joined and held together by every joint with which it is equipped, when each part is working properly, makes the body grow so that it builds itself up in love." The last part of that sentence is the culmination of chapter 4, makes the body grow so that it builds itself up in love. The final aim of what Christians are meant to be, a unified community that builds itself up in love. We're not primarily built up by knowledge or by self-discipline, but by love. The other things are important, but love is essential for those other things to be effective. According to Thayer's Greek lexicon, the Greek word for working in the phrase "when each part is working properly" is only used in the New Testament to describe supernatural power, not simply human effort. So for the church to thrive, we have to approach involvement in the church and life in the church depending ultimately and genuinely on God's empowering involvement, not just our determination or force of will. We shouldn't be surprised if we go in and just kind of like grit our teeth and give it a try and it doesn't work out. You know, we shouldn't say, "Oh man, it was supposed to work out." Well, no, it's not just a matter of gritting our teeth and trying really hard, you know. We've got to enter into that with the understanding that this is God that's going to make this happen. we are to be willing participants in that. So there is some, you know, teeth clenching involved, I think, and effort involved. But we can't just go into it and put forth our best effort and leave it at that and let that determine, you know, success or failure. Christ enables this growth of the church body, and then individuals choose to cooperate in maturing together. So the maturing of the community as a whole depends on each individual. And it depends on each individual one choosing to help hold that community together instead of, you know, so being a part of the solution in unity rather than, you know, a divisive personality. And two, it depends on each individual functioning in intentional partnership with the Holy Spirit. Okay, so looking at all this now, what's in all this for geeks specifically? I'm not, this is going to sound, especially since I'm doing this in the middle of the night or the early morning now, like I may be saying this off the cuff, but this is actually how I was feeling earlier this week and I wrote these notes. Maybe I'm just feeling especially antisocial right now, but I don't like, honestly, a lot of what these verses are telling me. I don't like the idea that in order to safeguard against bad thinking and false ideas, I need to be invested in local church community, submitting to local church leadership. I pridefully think of myself as pretty darn discerning. I like being spoken to in truth and love, except when someone wants to tell me I'm wrong about something. I hate that, and I wish they would go away. I also hate having to gear myself up to speak loving truth to someone else. Because between my shortcomings and their defensiveness, they probably won't see it as loving or as truthful. It'll just get heated and messy, and they probably won't change their mind anyway, so what's the point? I don't like the idea that I can't truly mature in the way God intends without intentionally engaging in the local church, being a part of the solution, helping it remain unified, and trusting that God will supply power as I take on what look like hopeless, pointless tasks. I don't like any of that. And yet I can't make it not exist. The words are there. They're true. So how do I even begin to get over those issues? As I thought about it, and as I looked back at the text and the context for these verses, I think that backtracking to verse 2 of this chapter is kind of a start for addressing that problem, that conflict, that just the attitude that I feel. The first word Paul uses to describe what this walk with Christ looks like in community with others, humility. A right understanding of where I'm really at, as opposed to where I'd kind of like to think I'm at and where I tell myself I'm at. Humility. It's a willingness to acknowledge my weakness and deal with the reality of my mess. And with the tireless patience and forgiveness of Jesus, I can begin to move in that direction. Because in light of Jesus, I can realize that my weakness and failure does not disqualify me as a functioning member of the body. My flaws do not rob me of significance or value in the church. So in light of grace, I can more easily look at my sin and see truth about myself, which allows me to move into some of those things that I normally want to avoid about engaging in the church that really have to do, as I chase them down, with my pride. The truth is that despite feeling like I discern pretty well, I've adopted false ideas into my thinking numerous times throughout my life. And even now, you know, from day to day, I find myself getting stuck and thinking the way the world thinks about what happiness is, what significance is, and a handful of other, you know, vital issues that I just fall into thinking the same way as the world. And I've been corrected from those modes of thinking by other believers in the local church, sometimes directly and other times just by something I heard them say in passing while we were hanging out and talking about life. Another problem is, you know, in isolation, as much as I love to be in isolation from other people, When I'm in isolation and trying to live out my faith in isolation, then it's really easy for me to just kind of cherry pick which books I want to give my attention to, which thinkers I want to, you know, prop up in my mind and allow to influence me and say, yeah, they know what they're talking about, you know. My course can just remain unchallenged by any other thought that I don't seek out and decide I'm going to, you know, value. I can then wander by doing that into false and harmful thinking, totally convinced I know truth that most other people haven't figured out yet, when in reality, I'm actually sinking deeper into falsehood. So I need the local church. And for the local church to be what it is and what it's meant to be, it needs me. I've got my mess, but I have some strengths in the mix too. And even though I'll stumble in trying to put those strengths into action in the local church, I'll grow and I'll learn from that and I'll ask forgiveness and still benefit others along the way. Because when the Holy Spirit is involved, when we willingly partner with Him, He can reduce or heal the damage caused by our sin and amplify the effectiveness of our service. As we serve and invest in the local church, we are not committing ourselves to pointless, hopeless tasks unless we're depending on our own strengths to make it all happen. Instead, all things become possible when we willingly partner with the Holy Spirit, seeking His direction and depending on His power to bring about God's will in our communities. Feedback as always. I'd love to hear from you. Give me your thoughts on this podcast, Christian Geek Central, the YouTube channel, anything else we're doing. What should we keep? What should we change? Or what's on your mind you'd like a potentially uninformed opinion on? I've got a few of those. We want to make this show and all of Christian Geek Central as fun and useful as we can, but we have to hear from you to do that. You can send me an email or audio file recorded on your phone to paeter@spiritblade.com. All right, well, let me just briefly pray in light of kind of what's been going on in our lives lately that maybe you guys can relate to. Lord Jesus, would you meet us in our day-to-day grind of work? And would you rescue us from the stress and anxiety that can come from that? Would you give us perspective that will just protect us from the wrong thinking that just leaves us vulnerable to these things that can bring so much stress and anxiety into our lives. And God, we know that that's a journey. That's something that just so atypically is changed overnight. And so in the meantime, in our weakness, we pray that you would just give us mercy and don't let these things break us unless that's really what you need to do in order to get through to us. We pray that you would be gentle with us as you teach us through our circumstances. We don't even know what the right balance is. You know, we don't want to turn away from how you might want to shape us, but at the same time, we're just afraid and we don't want that. We don't want it. It's just hard. It's hard. So we pray for your perfect balance. Help us to trust that you know what that balance is in stretching us and protecting us. Help us to just rely on you and to seek to go deeper into relationship with you, to understanding of who you are, what you've done for us, what you are doing for us, what you've promised to do for us in the future. And help us gain confidence from that to take us into and through our work days. In your name we pray. Amen. All right, well, guys, if you'd like some help finding a local Bible-teaching, truth-seeking church in your area, please email me anytime at paeter@spiritblade.com. I'd be happy to help you with that. I want to thank Matt McKinney and Kim Wiki of POSTOS for their review of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Speaking of them, stay tuned for DS9 Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 400 if you want to start from the beginning. Next week, if God allows it, I will not be recording this at 4 o'clock in the morning. And I'll be sharing with you more of some of my geek favorites from my bookshelf. And then also Winston Crutchfield is going to take us back for a dive into the long box, talking about Scooby-Doo, of all things. And I'm very excited to say that next weekend begins the Summer of Free 2017. So, and I've got some new kind of stuff cooked up for this summer that I've never done before, that I hope you guys will enjoy. A new kind of ongoing event to take us through the summer that I hope you guys will get involved in. And then next week, I'm not sure if I'm going to like take the audio and just put it on the podcast and use it as podcast content. But either on the podcast or just on the YouTube channel, you should be able to check out the first part of my series on the spiritual themes, the philosophical themes of Horizon Zero Dawn. So anyway, I hope you guys will enjoy that. Till then, check out spiritblade.com and Christian Geek Central for more stuff made just for you guys. Thank you so much for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week, and that you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth. And it's 5 a.m. I don't think I'm going to be going back to sleep. Oh my gosh. So that means I'm starting this day at 3:15. 3:15 a.m. That's the start of my day. Oh my gosh. I'm not 40 yet. I'm 39. I think this is the beginning of me becoming an old man. The beginning of the end.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Frampson with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.com. Thank you for listening.
Coming through the wormhole.
The Dominion has endured for 2,000 years and will continue to endure long after the Federation has crumbled into dust.
No!
5 years ago, no one had ever heard of Bajor or Deep Space Nine, and now all our hopes rest here.
Okay, and we have just watched Destiny. This is another emissary-oriented Bajoran prophecy, Bajoran religion story. What do you think, Kim?
I actually like this one. It's a little bit slow, but for once, Star Trek is giving religion a fair shake.
It is. The gist of it is they're doing this procedure where they're going to put a relay on the other side of the wormhole so that hopefully they can, through the magic of subspace, always see and hear what's going on the other side, so they have eyes on the other side, you know, to guard against the Dominion, to help do some scouting, etc. And here comes a Vedic saying that there's a long old prophecy in their Bible about that, you know, three vipers, and there's three Cardassian scientists coming on board, and all this stuff. And basically the gist of it is that Sisko has to decide whether he's going to believe in the prophecy or if he's going to do his job. Because the prophecy, as they're interpreting it, says, this is bad, you need to not let them do this thing. But his job says, let them do this thing. And, you know, like I said, there's a lot of hullabaloo in between, but that's the core crux of it. And, of course, they spend a lot of time discussing it. And, unlike other things in Star Trek, just like Kim said, they're actually pretty fair about it. And,
really, there's only one character in this whole thing of all the factions who has ill intent.
Yeah. And that person is found out and they're causing trouble and they're stopped. But it's fair, and it doesn't just come down and say you need to bow down and do whatever the prophets tell you either. At one point Sisko has to decide, is he going to do what the prophecy says, or is he going to do what his instincts say? And he goes with his instincts. And You know, part of it is the nature of what prophecy is. And from what I read in scripture, and this is true in fiction and in real life, prophecy is not intended to give us a sneak peek so we can change things. What prophecy is intended for is so that, which is why it's always vague, again, in either fiction or real life, is so that when this happens, you know that the person who made the prophecy knows what they're talking about. Therefore, when they say other things, you know to believe them.
You can look back and measure them by that. And yeah, they put it rather succinctly in a very silly movie, Kung Pao Enter the Fist.
Yeah.
But yeah, the idea is there that whether you're talking about...
What you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Either in history or in fiction, that attempting to thwart the prophecy is always futile.
Yeah.
Either what you're doing will actively cause it to come true, or you will be struggling to climb a muddy hill in the rain.
Yeah. And what I like is that this doesn't take the skeptic side, because, like I say, it doesn't just say you need to bow down and obey the prophets in all things, because, honestly, I don't think that's realistic anyway. You know, you don't read... I think doing that would be the equivalent of what Paul was doing with the Thessalonians, where they were just like, shut all their stuff down, put on their white robes, and go hide in the mountains and wait for Jesus to come back. And that's where Paul said things like, he who will not work will not eat, and all these other teachings about the end times, saying, you need to go about your regular lives, you need to go about your ministries, your regular lives, your families, all of that stuff. Jesus will return when Jesus returns. And it, don't do the Jack Van Impey thing. Don't try to come out with your checklist and try to just figure out, oh, this happens and this, the Left Behind thing where it's like, oh, we have the script, we know exactly what God's going to do. No, God will surprise us. The prophets
told you wouldn't be able to call the tropes.
Yes.
Do you really think you're smarter than God?
And that's what happened in this episode, is the prophets managed to surprise them.
Yeah.
Because there were misinterpretations, and it's clear, absolutely clear in the episode, the prophecy was true. But what they thought it meant was not what it meant. And so it works out, but again, it's not even just a matter of fatalism, of what will be. It's like, no, they still had to make decisions, they still had to do the right thing, and it's actually one of the most even-handed Star Treks I've ever seen on issues about religion and prophecy and faith, as opposed to going with your instincts.
Well, and I really like that scene about halfway through between Sisko and Kira, where Sisko says, you know, look, I can't just put the brakes on this operation because then I'm going to have to answer to my superiors. When they ask me why I put a stop to this, I'm going to have to give them a better reason than because an ancient Bajoran prophecy told me to.
Yeah, for the Bible tells me so. It's not going to work with your job.
She comes back at him, I think, quite reasonably. She says, okay, look, you call them wormhole aliens, I call them prophets. Fact is, they're outside of time. To them, tomorrow is the same as yesterday. They could very easily have dictated their knowledge about what's about to happen to some ancient Bajoran.
Yep, and much like with John and Revelation, one of the common theories about John is that many of the visions he describes that seem very bizarre are actually pretty literal, but he had no context to understand them. And again, that's only a theory. That's not an outright, you know, absolute truth. But things like that, the locust could have been a whole horde of attack helicopters based on the descriptions. And things like, you know, mountains falling out of the sky and exploding, things like that. Comets or nuclear bombs. And, you know, that's the whole thing, is there's so many ways to interpret, and it's not a matter of saying it's whatever you want it to mean. It's a matter of saying we will know the truth when it happens. You know, and I think one of the best examples, again, in real life scripture, is Daniel 10. It might be Daniel 11, but I'm pretty sure it's Daniel 10, where it's like basically all of the history between the Old Testament to the New Testament. And it is, except for the fact that it doesn't give proper names, but it does refer to specific rulers over and over again. So they're not just general terms. They're not proper names. Things like the King of the South, the Queen of this land, etc. And it goes through so accurately that the only thing skeptics can say is, well, that clearly must have been written after the events. And, you know, before it happened, it was so vague, you had no idea.
Yeah.
And I'm sure as those events were happening, I'm sure the priests were like, we don't know. But then after they happened, they're like, oh.
Now Now I get it.
And that's what this episode is all about, is that prophecy has its place. You just can't let it rule your life. It's a very balanced and mature view. Nothing too important for this as far as the storyline. And again, like Kim said, it's a fairly slow episode. There's an amusing little subplot with O'Brien. It doesn't really mean much. I would say check this episode out if you get a chance, but don't feel like you need to. Because the only thing that ever lasts is we have listening stations on the other side of the wormhole, but the only time that ever comes up is that they're mentioned. Well, all they have to say is we have listening stations. You don't really need to know the story of how it got set up.
I don't think they ever tell us anything plot critical.
Well, they do when the Dominion's coming in, because they start winking out. And so it's this nice ominous moment that our relay stations are one by one, pop, 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 as the fleet's coming. But, again, you don't need to know how they set it up to know that. So, if you want to see a surprisingly mature discussion of faith and duty and all that, check it out. But you don't feel like you need to. And, honestly, I'm not sure off the top of my head what's next to this, so we'll see you for the next episode.